Friday, friends. Greg Kokel here. Stand to Reason, thank you for being part of our show today. And we're going to have a great discussion this first hour with a friend and an author in a book that's got an unbelievable concept. We'll get to that in just a minute. But I have got to tell you, I am just completely blown away about something. For the last month, we've been doing our Be One of the 100 strategies to build up the a new group of strategic partners, people that climb on board, enlist with us as regular financial partners. And we did this last year, and we had a Be One of the 100, and we got 133 people, right? So it's funny how your prayers change when you're in a project like this. Because, you know, we're praying for our 100, and I've been talking to you about this for the last 4 weeks, right? And many of you are responding, and the numbers are coming in. I'm going, hey, that's cool. 100, Lord, 100. And then the numbers are moving up, and they're moving up. And I'm going, whoa, maybe we should be praying higher than we are because things are moving pretty fast. And so then I'm praying, I want us to beat the old record. Last year's 133, and the numbers are moving up, and the numbers are moving up. And finally, I just said, we've got a couple days left, and we got 133 that have already come in. And I said, team, I'm praying for 150. Okay, so as your prayers are answered in the minor, you know, keys, they start moving into the major keys. So that's the way it was for me. So I'm just going to tell you what the final number was as of midnight last night, because that was the end of our campaign to build our new company, platoon, cadre of enlisted strategic partners. And we finally ended up with 171. Oh my gosh, like no way, to which I say way, because we have such a fabulous group of people. I am so proud of you. I'm just borderline speechless, and I'm trying not to gush too much at you, but thank you so much. Just thank you so much. And of course, we thank the Lord, and every time those numbers kept coming in, and I'm saying, this is blowing my mind. I kept thanking the Lord. Well, you 171 know who you are. And actually, there were, in a certain sense, more than that, because there were 11 who were already strategic partners and said, well, we're going to kind of climb on for more. We're going to up our commitment. And so that added to the entire thrust for the month. And so my special thank you to those new strategic partners, and welcome to the team. Welcome to our kind of inner community of special people. I mean, everybody in our community is special, but Jesus had the 120, then he had the 70, then he had the 12, then he had the 3. So there are different levels of closeness in communities, and we count our strategic partners as our closest people because you guys make it happen more than anyone else. It's your consistent and faithful giving that keeps us afloat, keeps us going on, and keeps us really encouraged as this event did for me. These are hard times that we're going through. Next hour, I'll be talking maybe a little bit about some of those things. But man, to be able to know that in the most difficult times we're facing, as things are ramping up so much for us as a Christian community, that you guys are really on our side, no holds barred, going for broke, so to speak, as we stand in the line of fire for the truth of Christianity. And kind of along in that line, that's a nice little segue to what I want to talk about for the rest of the hour with my guest. You know, I have to say that as an apologist, it's difficult for me to stumble upon a new take on Jesus, all right, especially one that's not heretical. But today, I want to talk about an insight on Christ that's actually not really entirely new, because others have reflected on this in the past, and in some cases, they reflected on it deeply, but it's been a long time. I mean, it was before my time. And so in a certain sense, it's somewhat newly discovered and articulated so well by our guest today. It's certainly new to me. The insight is developed in a new book, just came out August 1st, I think, if I got my dates right, and it's called Too Good to Be False. How about that? Too Good to Be False, How Jesus' Incomparable Character Reveals His Reality. It's written by Tom Gilson. He's been on our show before. He's author of Critical Conversations, A Christian Parent's Guide to Discussing Homosexuality with Teens. He's the author of True Reason, Christian Responses to the Challenge of Atheism. I think we've had him on board for both of those and other things as well. Tom, great to have you back on the show.
Well, thanks for having me, Greg. It's good to be here.
Yeah, you know, buddy, I'm thinking about this title. I think this is a great title, too good to be false. And it's actually a good launch for my first question. In general, what are you getting at with that cryptic title? How would you characterize, say, the main point of the book? And I know you and I talked about this main concept, a couple years ago when you were knocking it around and trying to figure out what you're going to do with it. And I was really taken with it. But I'd like you to kind of flesh it out just a little bit more. Obviously, this hour we're going to get in a lot more detail about it, but just the main concept here, too good to be false.
Sure. Yeah, it's grown a lot since then, and the book is in three parts, really, and the first two are the ones that are encapsulated in the title. The first part of the book covers a whole series of ways in which Jesus is better than we realized. He's better than I ever knew. I mean, as I was studying for this, and I'm hearing people say, as they read it, that it's actually becoming a surprising experience of worship, of seeing Jesus in a new light in ways we haven't seen him before. But he's good in surprising ways that I'm sure we'll get into.
Yes.
But the where that goes as far as too good to be false is that skeptics have their theories about where the story of Jesus came from.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a story. If you want to agree with skeptics about one thing, you can do that. It's a story. It comes in four versions.
Part of the story of reality, if I can put
it
that way.
That's part of the story of reality, yeah. And stories come from somewhere. They have their version of where the story comes from, which is basically through a whole series of oral tradition that started out of psychological need, maybe, you know, had some political stuff thrown into it.
Right.
But it tends to be the sort of processes that will corrupt the outcome. And when you look at the character of Jesus, as I talk about in many ways in part one of this book, this is not a corrupted outcome. He is pure. He is consistent. He is unique. He is good in many, many ways. It just isn't conceivable. It isn't realistic to think that some kind of corrupting processes could have, you know, they'll say, well, you know, there's different number of angels at the tomb. So that proves that there was some problem in the process. I say, look at how similar, how consistent Jesus is throughout. You're missing the forest for the twigs.
Yeah. Yeah. You develop that notion a little bit towards the end of the book that if this is a story that's going out and kind of being modified and changed by the different faith communities as it goes out, like some have suggested, you cite this in the towards the end from the skeptics, like the telephone game. Well, you get all of these disparate stories and these wildly conflicting kinds of things. Wildly conflicting things. We don't have wildly. And it's not only the details, which is what a lot of people talk about, and what you focus here on, Tom, which I think is brilliant, is you're focusing on Jesus. And for me as a reader, I've been a Christian pushing this month 47 years, okay? So I've been around this stuff for a long time. It is so easy to, how can I put this? Well, I want to say take it for granted, but that's not a strong enough phrase. It's so easy for us to think of these kinds of claims that we'll get into in a moment as a kind of a same old, same old, same old. Oh, yeah, I get it. Yeah, Jesus said the gates of hell should not prevail against the church. Yeah, I saw that. And this other thing, you know, and he's always right. He never makes a mistake. Yeah, of course, he's God, right? Blah, blah, blah. But we haven't really thought about it as deeply as you have and expressed in this book. The ramifications of that just for answering the skeptic's charge. Now, you mentioned a moment ago about how people are really moved about the book. And I just, if it's okay with you, if it's not too embarrassing, I'm going to read some of the comments.
Oh, go ahead.
Blushing already. He's going, break my arm, right?
Yep.
This fresh, invigorating approach reignited my passion to worship Christ, one person says. Okay. By the way, J.P. Moreland's endorsed the book, and here's what he said, very, quite frankly, straightforward. I have never approached the Gospels in this way. And with Gilson's guidance, I have come to love, respect, and worship Jesus with renewed vigor and insight. Let me tell you why that's significant. Well, I know J.P., and I know he already loves, respects, and worships Jesus with plenty of vigor. All right. But for this to kind of send him into the afterburner, so to speak, or launch his afterburners, here's what some others say. This book totally shook me up. It helped me to reopen my eyes to how awe-inspiring and unbelievably wonderful my Savior is. I walked away with a renewed sense of awe for the person of Christ and some great logical points solidifying my faith that the gospel stories about Jesus are true. Here's another one. Reading it was as though I were meeting this amazing Jesus all over again. We marveled at his love and his goodness. Jesus' clever questions and brilliant responses, his leadership and humility all came alive. This book puts it all together. History, apologetics, a perfect character, and unexpected humor. Here's one. It says, this is the first work of apologetics that made me want to worship. You know, that's cool, but, you know, I write those books. I wish somebody would say that about my book, you know. It does something rare for a book on Christian apologetics. It provokes worship. Another same theme here. It moves us in the direction of not just the right answers and right actions, but right affections. And I found myself, this is not a strong point for me, Tom, as a Christian, the kind of the affective element, of, and I have to work on it all the time. Pray about it. It was this morning from the Psalms. But I felt my heart being moved by being able to see Jesus from a kind of a fresh or to see the things I already knew from a different angle to see how remarkable they actually are. So let's look at some of those things. You say in page 5, his way of living in the world couldn't possibly be a legend. What are your reasons for saying, making such a strong statement?
He's too unique. The reasons cover the various chapters in there, and there's many of them. But he's a legend is going to look different than that. In fact, in the appendix of the book, I have some legendary versions of Jesus, the apocryphal gospels, and you've got strange stuff where Jesus, you know, as a boy, gets mad at his playmates and kills them, and then brings them back to life a little later. The whole way of Jesus living, he was so majestic, so right. He had such incredible authority. He was so unexpected in terms of what a Jewish Messiah should be. He never said, "Our Father."
We'll get into some of those
things. Into some of these things without actually being committing to them here. We're going to commit to that one.
Yeah, we're gonna get into some of those particulars.
Okay.
I think it's a good launch. Yeah. I mean, it's this idea that, you know, legends don't look like this. I've heard other people say a similar thing, like this. Who could, if you think of real figures with power, real individuals, or literary figures with power, they don't. Neither the real folk or the invented folk use power the way Jesus did. And they don't talk the way Jesus did. And they don't act the way Jesus did. I mean, just simply setting aside the miraculous and all those other things, just looking at the individual, the character himself, that becomes, because he's so strange and unique in that fashion, that becomes kind of an apologetic for his reality. Too good to be false, as your title captures. He doesn't say the kinds of things that great characters usually say and do, and he doesn't do those kinds of things. Can you give us a few examples of that kind of thing? Something that Jesus says that you think, wait a minute. Yeah. And by the way, these are going to be things that many of people have already heard before because you read the Bible. But I want you to try to see it with new eyes. Go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, but to see it from another perspective, you look at the Sermon on the Mount and you know, the Old Testament prophets were always saying, "Thus says the Lord." And they were speaking as if for God, and they were speaking God's words, and they said, "Thus says the Lord." Jesus comes along, and you know, at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, you look at the last verse of chapter 7 in Matthew, it says the crowds were astonished because he spoke with authority and not as their scribes do. That wasn't that he had this really deep voice. That was, he just spoke it. He did not say, "Thus says the Lord." He did not say, "Thus says the scribes." If you had this in an academic textbook and you were talking about his, looking at his footnotes, every single one of his statements would have been footnoted. "Me, Jesus of Nazareth." He didn't. He didn't need any, and he went in, he was changing people's beliefs on his own authority.
Mm-hmm.
You don't do that. Nobody does that.
You know, there's something, I'm sorry. I was going to make another observation there from that same text where he's talking about the persecution. Blessed this, blessed that, blessed the other thing. And we all go, oh, that's so sweet and so nice. And that so encourages me. And he says, then blessed are those who are persecuted for my name's sake because they also persecuted the prophets that way. Who are the prophets representing? They were being persecuted for God's sake. And now Jesus is saying, for my sake.
And he said, in the same way. Yeah. He paralleled himself with God there. For those who say that the deity of Christ is only shown in the book of John, I'm sorry, it's all over the place.
Right.
And that's
right.
One of those subtle places, but if you look at it closer, what else could he be saying?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that is one of the passages, too, where he's saying, the ancients have told you, but I say. The ancients have told you, but I say. And it's interesting. He doesn't contradict the ancients. He just says there's more to what they said than meets the eye. And you develop that well, too. So there's that incredible authority from which he speaks. And that authority is himself. Who talks like that, huh?
Right. And, you know, who talks like that? You know, we should be more surprised by some of the things he says. And I talk in the book about the guest speaker or the new pastor candidate coming to, you know, audition, you might say, at your church. And he gets up front and he's at the pulpit and he says some nice warm words to make everybody feel good and everybody's nice together. And then he says, you need not worry that I've come to abolish the Bible. I'm here to fulfill it. What? I mean, there's a lot of problems with that. One of them is like abolish the Bible. That's like saying, you know, standing at the foot of the Rocky Mountains with a pickaxe saying, don't worry, I'm not going to chop the whole thing down. You know, who's worried about someone abolishing the Bible? And, you know, they'd have, and then to say that I'm going to fulfill it, this ought to bother us more, actually. It ought to drive us into going, okay, what kind of a person says that?
Mm-hmm.
And be more surprised by it. Because the more you're surprised by Jesus, as long as you stick with the truth, the more fun he is.
I hadn't thought of that particular point, but you're onto something there. You make the observation that you never see in the Gospels, Jesus talking about his own faith. Now, Paul does, and we should mimic his faith, but Jesus doesn't do that.
He doesn't. Is that not weird? I honestly, if anybody has ever seen this taught on before, I'd like to know about it. It's stunning. There is nothing in the Bible that says Jesus had faith. In Hebrews, it says he was found faithful, but I'm quite sure that what that means is that he was found reliable.
Yes,
or obedient, or that kind of aligns.
Not full of faith, but full of faith. Well, faithful, reliable. I guess it's the best way to put it right now. Yeah, you could count on him. He did what he was supposed to do.
Right. But does it say he had faith in the Father? Never, which is weird because his other virtues that we're supposed to emulate are in there. You know, it's his love, his compassion, his obedience, and then faith. You know, it is something Paul speaks of. We're supposed to follow that. So why is it left out of Jesus? And the only answer I can come up with that makes sense is that it's not that Jesus was lacking trust in the Father. Obviously not a lack there. It's that it had to have been, in some sense, the wrong word. And you could say it like, you know, I have faith that I can fulfill this big project at work over the next 3 months. I have faith in myself, or I have faith in you that you can do this. What you don't say is, I have faith that I can scratch my eyebrow. Because it's just like, it's just the wrong word. Even though you trust you can do it, it's the wrong word. I think what it's saying here, and the implication has to be, that Jesus had a trust relationship with Father that was so close, so tight, so intimate, that faith was the wrong word for it.
Yeah. Well, there's that kind of interpenetration of their natures that, that you can see described there in John 17, the high priestly prayer. He's just so there with the Father. And he wants us to have a similar kind of thing, which, by the way, is way beyond me. And I read John 17, I don't get it, you know. I'm in the resurrection when there's no flesh that'll, okay, maybe I'll do better. But right now, you know, that's out of my reach. But nevertheless, it wasn't out of Jesus' reach because he didn't even have to work at it. This was describing his very nature and the nature of his communion with the Father from the outset. Not something he learned to do or he perfected as he got better and better and better at it, you know. And that's something you develop nicely in the book. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned a few moments ago about Jesus. So we're talking about things about the character of Jesus. And this is, I think, more than anything else, the book focuses on the absolutely unique aspects of Jesus' character. And what we mean here is not just that he was virtuous, but there were other aspects of who he manifested himself as that were completely without parallel in anybody's life. And if anybody else would have said it than Jesus, people would have just laughed, or they would have stoned him. And actually, they did try to do that at one particular point. For example, you mentioned that he never referred to God as our Father. Okay, that's significant to you this line. Tell us.
He told the disciples to say that in the Lord's Prayer, but he never did. And he was actually really surprisingly careful not to. In the resurrection scene in John, I don't have it in front of me, but he said to Mary, he said, "Go tell the brothers that I go to my God and to your God, to my Father and your Father." There's something going on there because he's so careful. You never see him say "our Father" anywhere.
On the same level with the others in their relationship, the nature of the relationship they had with God.
Right. We can both call him Father, just as I say in the book, an Episcopal priest can have kids, and they will sometimes use the term Father for an Episcopal priest. Well, two boys playing together. One of them is the son of the priest. The other one isn't. And they want to go, climb up in the church belfry. The one who's the actual son of the priest will not say, "Hey, let's go ask our Father if we can do this." It doesn't fit. Mm-hmm. Let's go ask my Father. And the son will say, "Yeah, I wonder what the Father would say to that." They just wouldn't say it the same way. There is a different relationship. Right. And this is synoptic gospels all over the place.
Wow. Look, I'm just looking at my time. We passed our break time because I've been so caught up in this conversation. So let's go ahead and grab it right now. Talking with Tom Gilson, his book is Too Good to Be False, How Jesus' Incomparable Character Reveals His Reality. It's just out at the beginning of August, so we're 1 month into play here, Tom, and you're probably pretty busy with these kinds of things. I'm glad you joined us today to talk about this book. We'll be back with more conversation with Tom Gilson after this.
Have you seen our brand new website? Stop by str.org and enjoy a fresh, clean layout with all the same great content. The new Stand to Reason website was designed with you in mind. It has an easier-than-ever navigation and a crisp, simple layout so you can find all the sound analysis and careful commentary that you've come to expect from us. Browse new features that make finding your favorite resources easier than ever. As always, it's our goal to equip you, our fellow Christians, with the confidence, clear thinking, and courage you need for every encounter you have as a Christian ambassador. Our new website is just one way we're fulfilling that goal, allowing you to access the resources you need in a new and improved way. So visit str.org and keep coming back to discover new podcasts, articles, and videos each and every day.
Hey friends, would you like to be encouraged throughout your week with timely, relevant content meant to bolster your knowledge, wisdom, and character? Or maybe you have a desire to be connected with other like-minded Christians from around the world. If so, then you need to follow Stand to Reason on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Not only will you be able to interact with other Stand to Reason followers, but you'll also stay up to date and informed on our latest resources and events. In our current culture, it's important to have something of value to break up your social media feed. So just visit str.org and find the links to all of our social media platforms at the bottom of the homepage.
Talking with Tom Gilson here, author of Too Good to Be False. And Tom, you know, you authored a couple other books. We talked about Critical Conversations, about a parent's guide to discussing homosexuality with their teens, and True Reason, and that deals with atheism. I loved in that book, by the way, your critique of the debate that Bill Craig had with Sam Harris, and one aspect of it was really, really insightful. But you were the first one to tell me about Peter Boghossian. Do you talk about Boghossian and True Reason, or was that something else? Didn't you write a piece, like a book or something about Boghossian and his manual for creating atheists, his whole street epistemology deal?
Yeah, that's just an ebook that I put out on Kindle. It was really a compilation, more or less a blog post that I'd done answering his false definitions of faith and his false characterizations. Peter Boghossian, atheist tactician.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned blog posts. Where would people be able to find the things that you write like that on a daily basis, regular basis, whatever?
Yeah, two places. I've been blogging for 16 years at Thinking Christian, thinkingchristian.net. More recently, I'm a senior editor and a columnist at The Stream, stream.org. Which you can be biased and accurate at the same time, I think. I would call it the go-to place for a Christian perspective on current events.
I think that's a good one. You could have a point of view, and if that's what one means by a bias, without it twisting what the truth is. And that's a good distinction. ThinkingChristian.net and TheStream.org, right? I get that right?
Just Stream.org. Just. Yeah. Yeah, not
the stream. Oh, stream, not the stream.
Right.
Okay, stream.org. Mm-hmm. I wasn't sure. Mm-hmm. All righty. So we're talking now about your recently released book, Too Good to Be False, How Jesus' Incomparable Character Reveals His Reality. And here's a theme that you develop, and I hinted at it just a little bit in the first segment. But on page 17, you write this: the first great point in our study of what Jesus didn't do is he never let his extraordinary powers control him. He never even used them for his own benefit. It was always for others. Talk about how this, when you think about either real characters of note and fictitious characters of note, how this is so singular in the person of Jesus.
Yeah, this is stunning to me. This is the one that I've been that I talked with you about in the past, and really the one that took the deity of Jesus from a doctrine into the kind of thing that made me fall before him and say, "Oh my God. Lord, you are my God." Mm-hmm. He had, according to the story, you know, he had immense powers. Creator of the universe, that's, you know, Marvel characters.
You know, that's a little bit different.
There is no comparison. And when you look at powerful people, or even powerful characters, like in Marvel films, in mythology, you see... You don't see the kind of person that Jesus was. You look at powerful people, and then you look at, say, a list of characters or people who are incredibly other-oriented, giving, self-sacrificial. And those are different lists. The list of people that are both of those at the same time, they're just not the same. Lord Acton said power corrupts, tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Abraham Lincoln said, nearly every man can stand adversity, but if you want to test a man's character, give him power. Mm-hmm. Jesus stood the test. He never used his extraordinary powers for his own benefit. And I think, you know, if I got extraordinary powers, say economic, somebody gave me $1 billion, and I wanted to be really, 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 really good with it and give it all the way to missions and feeding the poor and stopping sex trafficking and everything, I'd still probably, get the brakes fixed.
Go out to dinner, treat it, right?
Yeah, he was hungry. And the devil was right when he said you could make these stones into bread, and he didn't.
You know, there's a, when you watch, you mentioned Marvel characters. One of the things about watching these superhero movies, and I watch them because my daughters watch them, you know, but Hollywood has got to what Hollywood considers, and they've got a point on this, what they figure is a quality or a more three-dimensional rather than one-dimensional kind of look at a character is that the character struggles with that character's flaws.
Yeah.
So you see who's the Tony guy, you know, of the super guy, the technology guy and all these super – see, I don't even know all the names, but his name's Tony, and he died in the last movie.
Can't help.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Right.
Oh,
so
man.
the ex-con, man, the actor. But anyway, he made quite a comeback. But he's a flawed individual, and he plays a flawed individual. And you see this, and this is what makes the movie interesting because they have to demonstrate the reality of humanity. Humans are flawed.
Right.
But we do not see that in Jesus, but we don't see a one-dimensional character. We see someone that is fuller and richer than any fictitious character that's ever been created.
Yeah, isn't this astonishing? He ought to be the most boring character in all literature because he never struggles. He never improves. You don't see any character growth. You don't see that in him. And that kind of character in any other literature is boring. You don't get a compelling character out of that. But, you know, is Jesus compelling? I think the record says a lot of people have been kind of interested in him for a little while. I mean,
I remember when William Lane Craig offering his own testimony. I don't know if you heard it. And I just remember this detail from it because he was just giving it very quickly. He said, when I started reading the Gospels, I was faced with the most extraordinary individual I'd ever met, something to that effect that Bill said. Mm-hmm. And he was utterly taken. And I'm thinking of another fellow that I know who's now a Christian but was an atheist, a Parisian. And he told me, when he went to Gospels trying to disprove them, but he was immediately taken with two things. First of all, these things read like history. They didn't read like mythology. That was the first thing. Second thing is that Jesus was really smart. He was amazed and taken with how smart Jesus was. And by the way, the other thing that he kept asking himself is, why did a guy like this have to die? Why did he have to die? Why did he have to die? Over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. And then that's when he realized he died. Well, he talked about his own guilt experience when it was came crushing in on him, and then he realized Jesus died for him. But this does underscore what we were just talking about. How did Jesus use his power?
Yeah.
He could have gotten off that cross.
He didn't even have to be born. That's crazy, too. There was a guy in India a couple of years ago who sued his parents for wrongful birth.
That's right.
Wrongful birth. He kind of get the sense if he'd signed an advanced informed consent form, he would have been okay with it. Well, Jesus did. And he didn't just consent to be born. He consented to die. The rest of us, some of us may have the ability to choose how we die. We don't get to choose whether we die. He did. It was so voluntary.
I actually, you anticipated my next question here because, you know, you hear teenagers say like, well, I never asked to be born. I probably said that when I was a teenager, you know, to my dad. Well, I never asked to be born, you know, as if this is a really meaningful point in a discussion kind of thing. But you're right. And I when you make this comment about Jesus, he not only had a say in his birth, but also in his death. He was born to die. I think of this verse in Hebrews, is it 10, where he said, when he came into the world, he said, in Holbert's offerings, you have not desired, but a body you have prepared for me. Okay? Behold, I have come to do your will, O Lord. So he knew, I mean, that should be on a Christmas card. You know, that's the verse that you'll never see on a Christmas card, but it's a great kind of nativity point, although it's dark because Jesus came to die. And that was something he had a choice in. Who does that?
Right. It's a stunning character, one way after another. And you spoke earlier, and I kind of already said it, of people finding this a worship experience. It was for me in writing the book. Hmm. It really was.
Hmm. Well, there's another point that you make here, and that it's that Jesus was never stumped, and that you never get these moments like, oh, I wish I'd done better at that. You know, I mean, you and I, we know this all the time. We get these encounters and we have these presentations. We think, oh, man, I could have improved that. Why did I say that kind of deal? But we never have that with Jesus. That's because he never had to investigate. As you pointed this out earlier, he spoke from his own authority.
And his teaching looks so simple. But you can't call a man simple, or you can't say anything against a man's intelligence if he says exactly the right thing to every person he encounters, which he did.
Yeah,
that on its own is enough to make him unique.
That's a hard character to create.
Okay, I'm not seeing
there
Greg
we go.
Here.
I think we're back. Okay, I think
okay,
we're back.
Good.
You froze out there for just a second with me. I'm changing a little thing on my computer. Maybe that'll help. So, on that line, you know, in John 8, you know this passage about the woman caught in adultery, that the textual evidence is not in favor of it being a part of the original, you know, where Jesus said, let you without sin cast the first stone. But I actually think, from the textual evidence, it's not part of John's original gospel, but I think it's an event that actually happened. And the reason I think it actually happened is because the way Jesus cleverly maneuvers in that circumstance. And I don't know, you probably have read other books, Tom, that claim to be Jesus speaking, but then when he starts speaking in their book or in their whatever, you know, you realize that isn't the way Jesus talks. He didn't talk that way. But when you read John 8,
I tried it in this book where I tried and put it to say what Jesus would say in a certain situation, and I just gave up and I put in parentheses. You wouldn't believe how hard it is to write something that sounds like Jesus.
You know what? Here's what we do. Guys like us do, and like tactics and stuff. We teach this stuff. You anticipate an objection and the way it comes across, and then you work really hard trying to think about how you might say it, so that when you're in the moment, you're quick. You appear to be quick on your feet. Okay, and then you're ready for it, and then you can hopefully deliver well and own the moment in the best way. But Jesus, there's no sense that Jesus ever did that. He always owned the moment. When did he ever get caught up short, speechless? When did he ever get bested by anyone?
Yeah, when did he even pull aside to think about it?
Yeah.
It just, brilliant. Dallas Willard wrote about that in The Divine Conspiracy. I owe a lot to him for that perspective, but you see it if you look for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, we got to take another break. We'll come back in a moment, and then I'm going to read something for your book that is just absolutely clever, and I want you to respond to it. It has to do with Jesus' leadership, and we've touched on some of those points already, but we'll get to the heart of that particular point about the uniqueness of Jesus with Tom Gilson, author of Too Good to Be False, when we return here on Stand to Reason.
Did you know Stand to Reason has a YouTube channel? We release a new video each Monday on the topics you care about. Through short, engaging videos, our speakers train you on tactics, offer apologetics tips, answer common theology questions, and address big issues in the world today. Join tens of thousands of other subscribers so you can stay up to date when we release a new video. Just go to youtube.com and search STR Videos, all one word, and hit the subscribe button. That's STR Videos. Take advantage of this free resource to help you stay informed, encouraged, and equipped as you share your worldview with others.
Do you want to become a more knowledgeable Christian ambassador without sitting through a formal course on apologetics? Well, we've made that possible for you through our STR Quick Reference app. Available for free on iTunes and Google Play, the STR Quick Reference app holds a wealth of information summarizing what you need to know on a range of topics. Learn how to defend the faith, see how other worldviews compare to Christianity, and master the biblical view of morality, all through short, engaging videos. Before you know it, you'll be well-versed on a number of important apologetics topics. In addition, the Quick Reference app also includes a Bible with text and audio, as well as some featured STR resources, all to enhance your learning experience. The STR Quick Reference app will equip you to engage in thoughtful conversation about the key issues of life from a classical Christian perspective. Visit iTunes or the Google Play Store today and download the STR Quick Reference app. And if you enjoy the app, make sure you give it a 5-star review.
Back with you here, Greg Kokol, on Stand to Reason, my guest Tom Gilson, and his new book is Too Good to Be False, How Jesus' Incomparable Character Reveals His Identity. Tom, I wanted to talk for just a moment about this clever way you characterize something paradoxical about Jesus' leadership approach, I guess, is maybe the best way to put it. And you have this like memo here. How would you respond if you receive this memo about a potential new employee, okay? And it says, I can't find anyone, he'll say, that you've ever seen him learn from experience, especially from any of his own mistakes. No one says he's ever admitted to making a mistake, actually. His leadership skills haven't improved one bit since he started out. I've checked his bio and I can't find a single sign of any character growth in him, not even a trace of it. Rarely will he give a straight answer when you ask him a question. And if you've got an opinion and it's different than his, well, you're just wrong. It's do it my way with him or his way or the highway. No exceptions. He won't even be friends with anyone who won't do what he commands. Yep, he actually does that word. And then you add, well, boss, should we hire this guy, you know? And this points out, you cite Philip Schaff in the book, and it said, Jesus teaches the world as one who had learned nothing from it and is under no obligation to it. Respond to that or just expand on that a little bit for us, Tom.
Yeah, he's got so much authority going for him. Yeah, but you think of working for a person like that, and you'd run like crazy from a boss like that. Who would want to work for a boss who never admitted a mistake, didn't care what your opinion was except to tell you if you were wrong? He ought to have failed with that as a leadership profile. I've got a master's degree in organizational psych. Mm-hmm. That's just an absolute recipe for failure as a leader. And yet, there's, shall I say, no sign that he failed as a leader. That's an understatement. So something about him must have overcome what we would call leadership failures. And the fact that he didn't make mistakes, the fact that he had credible authority, the fact there must have been something about him that was really tangibly, noticeably loving. Mm-hmm. And yet I suspect that maybe the reason not everybody followed him is because he was just kind of too good for them to be able to stand. You have to be able to accept that kind of authority and love in order to follow
well,
a man like Jesus.
Yes, Lewis develops the idea that being in the presence of perfect goodness is a kind of a dangerous place to be. And
yeah.
This is why, Aslan's not a tame lion and all of that stuff,
Mm-hmm.
There's another remarkable claim that you talk about of Jesus, and you just hinted at it a moment ago with your aside about no one could say that he failed as a leader, is that he actually says, and again, this is one of those things where I know he said that, but we don't realize how audacious it is. He actually says that the movement he started would continue to the ends of the earth and to the end of the world, and even the gates of hell would not prevail against it. And he didn't say that with a smirk or a snicker, and nobody raised their eyebrows when he said that kind of thing. Well, it's
right.
Just absolutely singular.
Yeah, somehow we've come to accept that as being kind of, oh, yeah, well, you know, he said that. Yeah, that's just normal Christianity that's in there. That was a very strong claim to make. The fact that he's proving to be right, we are within a few hundred people groups of reaching what he said in Matthew 24:14, the gospel of the kingdom would be taken as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come, whatever that means. But even to predict that it'll be taken to all nations, that's huge. One man, just one man.
And considering that he died an ignominious death and that his relatively small band of followers dispersed immediately, almost to a person, and yet here 2,000 years later, it's the largest religion on the planet. You know, I often think, Tom, about the fact that soon after Muhammad's death, within 100 years after Muhammad died in 632, he was on the Muslim armies were on the verge of taking over Europe at the Battle of Tours there in 732. And they were defeated by the Hammer, you know. I'm trying to think of his name, his real name. But so they didn't expand. So within 100 years, they were able to take over the whole Mediterranean region. But they did it by the sword. And what gets me, though, is Christians did the same thing. It took them 300 years. But the only blood they shed was their own. Okay? What manner of person inspires and ensures a movement that spreads like that in the midst of such terrible persecution? This is all part of the package, it seems to me.
Yeah, he led a revolution of the heart. Nothing harder than that. There's nothing to compare to that. No one's done that but him.
Tell us about Jesus the friend. I mean, we've been talking about Jesus the, in a certain sense, the unbelievable individual. That no one can compare. You can't even create a person like this, which turns out to be a fairly potent argument against the skeptics, and you deal with that later in a whole section of the book dealing with that. But tell us about Jesus, our friend.
Yeah, you know, this actually grew out of – I was disturbed even by Jesus, how do you call it? He was just so different. So much, so far beyond me, so unreachable in so many traits, so many. It's just like, okay, he's there, I'm here, I'm in trouble, he's God. And then I had to remember that he said in John that he, no longer do I call you servants, but I call you friends. That he's adopted us into his family, that he died for us so that we could be reconciled to God. That there's an intimacy that happens in spite of that difference, but it's not like buddies. It's not, you know, best buds. It's he does say, "You're my friends if you do what I command."
Right.
There's a very asymmetrical relationship there, but it's an asymmetrical relationship of love and intimacy.
Right. Yeah, that's a great observation, and it's just been, I think, in the last year since I have been my prayer life is directed at the Father, because I think that's the biblical model. And Tim Keller had some great teaching on our Father kind of aspect of the prayer that Jesus gave to his disciples. And so that's been my focus. But I've in the last year, I've been kind of revisiting this other concept and reminding myself, wait a minute, I have a Father, but I also have a friend. And the friend is Jesus. And it's not that the Father isn't friendly in a certain fashion, but it isn't Jesus is the one who identifies himself as our friend. Now, there are Psalms that refer to the Father being a friend too, but there's since Jesus is the human being that in some sense we can relate to. It just reminds me of the kind of hero worship when you run into somebody in a strange circumstance. I was watching a movie last night with Traded on this, and the guy saw this musician. He said, "That's this famous guy. I didn't even know he's sitting right there in front of you. Oh my gosh, I can't believe it!" And then the guy invites him over to sit down and have a chat, and he's just totally floored. That's the kind of thing you're talking about in this particular section of the book, where you're invited to be a friend with a great person who is willing to deal with you in an intimate way, in an accepting way.
And it's glorious. And it's one of the reasons that, and there's so many, but it's one of the reasons why no matter what, I mean, that's actually the title of part three of the book is Jesus, No Matter What, mm-hmm. that he calls us to follow him and he's worth following no matter what.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's your final section there. Right? We're not going to have time to get into it. I'm looking at the clock right now.
No.
We just blown through this hour. We still have a few moments. And maybe there's a whole section that you have just on dealing with the skeptic, because in part two of the book, you devote your efforts to a different question. And this story that we've been talking about, it may sound too good to be false, but there's a whole lot of people that say it is false. And so there is a very particular way that you position your argument here against that charge. You answer some of the standard kind of issues, but there's something more that – so tell us about that, how you approach that issue here.
Yeah, and the fun of this is that you can actually make a case for the historicity of the Gospels without knowing the typical things, which is, you know, like when were they written, when were they put down, how long does it take for a legend to develop. The skeptics have their explanation for where the story of Jesus came from, which is basically it arose out of psychological need when their leader was killed and they pinned everything on him and they needed to keep it going. And I don't have time to develop the cognitive dissonance theory, but sometimes people will invent crazy things, and they invented a resurrection. And then to prop themselves up in that, they'll proselytize, they'll spread it. And so the disciples did that. And then it took off all around the Mediterranean. And by word of mouth, oral tradition, Bart Ehrman, in three or four of his books, he's the lead skeptic on this theory, says a telephone game, send it around the Mediterranean and everywhere, and it came back and it landed in these four Gospels. Well, there's a couple of big problems with that. One is that those are very highly corrupting processes. And it doesn't come back corrupted. We talked about that earlier in the hour.
Mm-hmm. Before you move on, Tom, I just want you to talk about that a little bit more, because I think that the point that I don't want people to miss this, because I think it's really important. The point that Ehrman is saying is this: it is a corrupting process. It goes out, and this is why you can't trust the accounts. It goes out and gets corrupted. But your response to that, go ahead and tell us again.
Well, yeah, he says, what happens to stories in the telephone game? They change. And I go, well, that's an awfully weak word for it. They're going to be completely different. You know, Ehrman doesn't know the power of his own theory to mess up a story.
Mm-hmm.
But there's this other thing going on. I mean, I used to live in Orange County near San Juan Capistrano, where the swallows came back every spring the same day. Something's navigating them there. What Ehrman and the others propose is that we've got this thing going out to all of the four winds, and then it lands in four places. But it lands with the same character of Jesus. It even lands with the same character of Peter and John, probably, mm-hmm. too, but definitely those two. What was guiding all of those stories to come back and land in the same place? If some mad scientist scrambled the brains of some of these swallows in San Capistrano, and yet they came back and landed in the same place, you'd say, well, no, the scientist brain scrambler was a dud.
It didn't work.
And I think Ehrman's scrambler is a dud, because mm-hmm. the story lands the same place mm-hmm. in all four cases.
So what we have, though, is the story goes out and then comes back in these four cases, and it gives us almost a perfectly exact a replication of the same kind of man we've been talking about. We're not saying there aren't differences mm-hmm. in some of the synoptics, et cetera, or with John's got a lot of new material, but we're saying that the same kind of unbelievable individual who can't even be fabricated in a fiction, you know, we're saying that this unbelievable person was fabricated through a willy-nilly process of people just throwing things around and adding things on, and then they all come back to land, and there's tremendous fit before the synoptics, which is why they call them the synoptics, the same eye. They see the same Jesus, as it were, and that's the point.
Yeah, and that's actually part of the reason the word character is in the title, Jesus, incomparable character. The skeptics tend to focus on what they call differences in the plot. I look at the character. The character is the character, and it's there. It's him everywhere you look.
He's the same individual, the kind of person that just can't be invented.
Right. Oh, they think this is an easy story to make up. You know, any old legend could do it. No, I'm sorry.
Yeah. How do you invent the story of a God-man is one of the ways that you put the question in chapter 11. How do you mix God and man in one character, especially if your story includes a trial and an execution? Mm-hmm. Why don't you close us with that thought? We got about 60 seconds here.
You look at him in the trial and the execution, and you go, there is one real, honest-to-goodness human being. He's in pain. He's being killed. The prayer and everything.
He's agonizing.
Tortured. It's awful. And yet, at no moment is there any doubt who's in charge. He is in complete control of the process. That actually bothers the people who are trying him. Mm-hmm. He is human. He is God. You try writing that story. Good luck. You're not going to invent that. This has to be real.
Well, I've been talking with Tom Gilson here this last hour. His new book is Too Good to Be False, available where all good books are found, which is not too many places anymore because the bricks and mortar closed down, but Amazon certainly has. I found it there earlier. And the subtitle, How Jesus' Incomparable Character Reveals His Real Identity. And this is really, you know, as I've been reading through it, folks, I found my heart being strangely warmed by what I read there, you know, because it helped me to see the things that I had kind of taken for granted about Jesus in a new light. It helped me to see how absolutely unique these characteristics are in the person of Jesus. Tom, thanks for spending time with us today, and appreciate your hard work for this good book.
Oh, thanks. It's a pleasure. So good to talk with you.
All right, friends, that takes care of it for this hour. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. You give them heaven this week. Bye-bye now.